let's begin. I have a number of comments and responses to things, but I'm going to save that to the end. I want to begin. I think we could finish up with the stipler in a half hour, if not less. And then, depending on the time, either I'll take some of these questions I had and comments, and then maybe we'll start with the Chasam Sofer, or if not, we'll see how long we go on those things. I've been holding some of these for many weeks. If not, we'll just continue with that today, and we'll start the Chasam Sofer next week. Let me just grab some stuff here. The only thing I do want to say is that I investigated at the end of last class, we had some discussion what exactly the relationship is of Shaul Berlin to both the and to Rabbi Yaakov Emden. So I investigated it. I got the answer. I was not able to find the answer in J.J. Schachter's dissertation or in David Katz's dissertation. I did find it in a book, Ateret Tzvi, which you can see it on HebrewBooks.org. It's a biography, a scholarly biography, of Tzvi Hirsch Levin, so the father of Shaul Berlin. He was the chief rabbi of Berlin, and before that he was the the chief rabbi of London, or the Av Beistin of London. In Rabbi Blech's books, in one of his contemporary halachic problems, he discusses... I think it's in his article dealing with kosher birds, the Muscovy duck, one of those things. It's in volume 3 or 4. He talks about an English rabbi known as Hart Lyon. H-A-R-T, first name, L-Y-O-N. And Blech clearly doesn't know who this guy is. Hart Lyon is no other than Tzvi Levin, Tzvi Hirsch Levin, one of the great gedolim in the late 18th century, who, after leaving London, comes to Berlin. And Tzvi Hirsch Levin's son is Solomon Herschel, who becomes the first official chief rabbi of England, then succeeded by Nathan Marcus Adler. But in England, they anglicized his name. They of Tzvi Levin, Tzvi as Hart, Hart Lyon is Tzvi Levin. So let me give you the genealogy here. Rav Shaul Berlin's father, as we have just said, is Tzvi Hirsch Berlin. His father was the famous Rav Aryeh Leib of Amsterdam. Now, Rav Aryeh Leib was married to Rav Yaakov Emden's sister. Aryeh Leib's father-in-law was Chacham Tzvi, which means that Shaul Berlin's great-uncle is Rav Yaakov Emden. And in fact, I don't know if Shlomo's with us. Shlomo had mentioned that. That is found in Katz's dissertation. What isn't found is as follows, and a little more trickier, the Note of Yehuda's relationship. The Note of Yehuda refers to Shaul Berlin as Shin Bet, the abbreviation Shin Bet, which means relative. It doesn't say what type of relative or how distant it is. So here it is, if anyone wants to write this down. Rav Yecheskel Landau, the Note of Yehuda, was a descendant on his mother's side. He was a great-great-grandson of a certain Rav Heschel. Now, this Rav Heschel was the Rav of Brisk, or any of the great rabbis of Brisk. We don't know much about this Rav Heschel. Now, Rav Heschel had a son named Rav Shaul. The son of Rav Shaul was Rav Aryeh Leib. And Rav Aryeh Leib's son, Rav Aryeh Leib was married to Rav Yaakov Emden's sister. So that's the relationship. That doesn't really put them actually... Rav Shaul Berlin's grandfather is Rav Aryeh Leib, and the Note of Yehuda is descended on his mother's side, a great-great-grandson of this Rav Heschel, and this Rav Heschel is all... And Shaul Berlin is probably the great-great-great-grandson of Rav Heschel. I don't know what you make that. Fourth cousins, twice removed, however it works. Quite distant relatives. But as I mentioned last class, in Europe, there was the rabbinic elite kept track of their genealogies. So if anyone wants me to send you the details on this, which wasn't so easy to find, but I can send it to you. Let us begin. We ended last class. The last thing we did is I spoke about the Stifler's attitudes towards telling about the Haskalah, the Vesamim Rosh. Yeah, that's what Yossi explains what it means. Shar Basari, that Basari, you know, the flat, or the connected. You find it in Tanakh, the expression. One other thing, there's a few other points I need to discuss with the about the Stifler. And that it was, the first one is his widely known and widely publicized criticism of asceticism in sexual matters. Now, we are accustomed to be told, growing up, the various articles written about how Judaism, unlike Catholicism, values the body, values physicality, etc., etc., and I believe that is true. However, as with all things, you can't speak about Judaism per se. You can speak about most Jews. Fact is that there is great asceticism now in certain circles. I wrote about it on the one of my blogs, and I spoke about it on these classes. I don't know if it was last semester or the semester before. I gave my explanation as to why there needs to be a commandment. Be fruitful and multiply. Look around the world. People are fruitful and multiply without there being commandments. What do you need to have a commandment for this? And I explained, and I believe this is correct. I've never seen anyone say it, but I believe it's correct, that needed this because although the average person would marry and have children, without an explicit command, you would have developed in Judaism, as developed in Christianity and in Eastern religions, an ascetic class. Because most people would conclude that if you want to be spiritual, you want to separate yourself as much as you can from physicality because you want to be special and holy. And therefore, sexual matters are physical, so you would follow the lead of all those other religions and you'd have a class, a spiritual class, a celibate class. It's not unexpected that we have that in Catholicism and in other religions. And therefore, in order to prevent this, you needed a commandment to show that everyone is obligated in marital life and family life, so you can't have a situation where you have a special class. And then, of course, you have the Ramban and others, it's actually not the Ramban, attributed to the Ramban in Yerat HaKodesh, who speak about positive aspects of sexuality, etc. However, despite this, you do have strong ascetic tendencies. You have passages in the Talmud that speak are quite ascetic. What you have, in other words, is you have traditions in Judaism that, while acknowledging obviously the need for a marital life and for mitzvah, once that is accomplished, or even while that's being accomplished, you have people who've advocated complete asceticism with the exception of the mitzvah. In other words, you can fulfill the mitzvah pru or vu and be completely ascetic in other ways. Now, you might say, well, that distorts the whole point of the Ramban, of the Gerat HaKodesh, and of the meaning of the idea of Pru Revu, of what the Ketubah says about a man is obligated to satisfy his wife. However, there's always different interpretations. The Rambam himself mentions that the sense of touch is disgraceful to us. So he obviously saw sexuality as a mitzvah, an obligation, but something we have to do because God commands it, but it's not something we would prefer on our own to do, but we're obligated to do it. And this is attacked as basically heretical in the Agarat HaKodesh, and Rav Yaakov Emden attacks it, and others attack it, but there were people who followed the Rambam. Let's take it into contemporary times. And by the way, if you want to see an example of this, just open the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, and if you want to see some... But as youngsters, we would say, is really scary stuff. Quite ascetic there. Today, there is asceticism in the Hasidic world is identified with the Gerer Hasidim. And it is said that the Stifler, in this letter I'm going to describe in a minute, was directed to the Gerer Hasidim. Although, if you look at the letter, it's addressed to one person in particular who maybe was a Gerer Hasidim. One person in particular. I mean, maybe a Gerer, maybe not, but it was... Word went out that this was directed against the Gerer Hasidim. And this letter that we'll speak about in just a minute, this originally was never published. It's handed about. Well, why the Stifler never published it? Perhaps because he didn't want to get into a dispute with the Gerer Hasidim. But it was widely passed around. And then there was a rabbi named Nathan Drazen. It's an old rabbinic family. He was an early musmach of Yeshivas Rav Yitzchak Elkanan. His son, he has a son, Rabbi Drazen. First name is escaping me. Someone will write it in. Son has recently published a couple books on the Rambam. He's become very interested in the Rambam, but he really is an expert on Targum. He translated, I believe, all five volumes of Uncleus. He did it some on his own, some with Bernard Grossfeld, and he lives in Boca Raton now. He's retired. Someone will email me his first name. No, not Stanley. You're thinking of Stanley Wagner. He did it together with him. Someone will look it up. Just as I'm talking, someone will find it on Amazon. Just plug in Targum Uncleus or Drazen. Although he was always a scholar, and as I said, before he got into the Rambam, Israel Drazen, thank you. And his books on the Rambam have not been well received at all. Harsh criticism, and some of this criticism is quite deserving, if I may say so myself. Because his real area is Targum. He was, if I'm not mistaken, what I'm going to tell you I think is still correct, it certainly was correct for a time, the only chaplain, Jewish chaplain in the U.S. Army who reached the rank of general. I'm certain that that is still correct, and he not only was the first, I think to this day is the only Jewish chaplain to reach the rank of general. I actually was given, I have these people who send me these things, I don't know why they send it to me, but some of them I use. Later I'll hope to mention one of these things in a minute. It was a Chabadnik. He found the letter of, well, the Lubavitcher Rebbe wrote letters to Drazen, because Drazen was the head chaplain in the army, and Drazen's letters to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Rebbe's encouraging Drazen on how to spread, the Noahide laws, and Drazen's writing back to him. I then sent it to Drazen, because I didn't know if he had the letter that he wrote. I met him when I was scholar in residence in Boca Raton last year. So his father published a book in Hebrew called, get the title of the book, Zivug Min HaShemayim or something like that, as Marriage Made in Heaven. And in there, he published the letter, significant portions of the letter, not the complete letter, but the important parts of the stipler. And subsequently, it appeared in print and in the five-volume collected talks and discussions and letters of the stipler. You find the complete letter in volume 5. So I guess that, thank you. That would be the equivalent of Rear Admiral, I guess would be the equivalent of General. But if anyone knows, the chaplaincy, you can investigate this further. Or if any of you are in Florida right now and you know Rabbi Drazen, you can ask him the details. I don't even know. I know he was in Washington, I think, for a while. I'm not sure. I mean, he had a long, long career in the military. I don't know if Robinson, you could tell me maybe, Ethan, you know, was Robinson, which denomination was he? So getting back to the Gerer Hasidim. The Gerer Hasidim were quite ascetic. Their asceticism has, to this day, never been published. Officially, it hasn't. All we have are some people who left the Gerer movement who've spoken about it, but they, as far as I know, have also never actually put the data. There's booklets and pamphlets that are literally unobtainable outside of Gerer Chassidus. There is this woman, a well-known woman, who became irreligious, but she would not have the pamphlet. I am unaware of any well-known Gerer men Chassidim who became irreligious after they were married, because they're only given this after they're married. They would be able to publish this. It is the document given to all Gerer grooms with their extreme behaviors, which include, this is a family program here, I don't want to get too detailed here, but basically, it's basically to fulfill the marital act, and that is it. No cuddling, no foreplay, nothing. And after a child, supposedly, you're not supposed to have any physical contact for a complete year, men and women are not supposed to walk together. On the street, extreme, extreme tendencies that go from the previous Rebbe, the Ein, Rav Avraham Mordechai, which the Rebbe following him, apparently, they say, tried to soften some of them, but extreme, extreme asceticism. So basically, you fulfill marital obligations, but there's no physical connection whatsoever between husband and wife, and that would seem to violate what the Ketubah says that there has to be married alike. It would seem to violate all sorts of not only halachot, but the basic ethical values between husband and wife, and really seem to make a mockery of the idea that the sexual relationship is important for marriage, because here you have a complete removal of this relationship and saying that it's only for children. And so you see already that this is not normal. When I say normal, not mainstream traditional Judaism. Thank you, Ethan. Now, the issue that the Stipor had to deal with is, though, complicated, as I said, because there is also this ascetic tradition. For example, there are texts that speak about during sex your mind should be on holy things. So then you can see how you can easily make the jump from there to say, well, if my mind can't be on holy things, then better to abstain completely, better to be celibate. The normal, the mainstream position would be no. It doesn't. Mean you do that. It means you attempt to, even if they had to, even for those who adopt this assumption that your mind should be on holy things, etc., their attitude would be that if you can't, well, that's something to work to, but not that you abstain completely. But you can see already how you have the building blocks there if you want to create an entirely ascetic lifestyle. So the Stipler in his letter is forced to acknowledge that asceticism does have its place, a tradition when it's a Shem Shamayim, and when the wife agrees to such a lifestyle. There's the rub, of course, because although the Stipler is going to speak very strongly against this lifestyle, he has to acknowledge that if wife agrees to it, there's free choice. Husbands and wives can do what they want to do. Therefore, if the wife agrees to it, it's permissible. But as I said, the rub is as follows, that you imagine a situation where you have, let's say, a 25-year-old man who is trying to become some super pious, holy figure. And he tells his wife this is how he wants to live. Especially in those societies, the Hasidic societies, what does it mean to say the wife agrees? For a wife in those societies to oppose her husband and to go so far as to approach rabbis, etc., that's very unusual. Most women would feel forced to go along with this. At the most, they maybe would talk how upset they are to their friends, but in fact, many of these wives would feel ashamed. After all, here their husband wants to become the next great sage, the holy person, and she's trying to bring him down by saying that he has to have some physical connection. You could see how this would what this would do to her ego, that she's just some hedonist, wants to have some sort of hedonistic lifestyle because she wants to have some sort of physical relationship with her husband. If someone wants to criticize the Stipler's letter and say it doesn't go far enough, I think it would be from that standpoint to say that he acknowledges that there is this notion of L'shem Shamayim, and that if the wife agrees, and he doesn't really point out that in reality, can the wife really agree? Although he does then go very strongly and say, but if the wife doesn't agree, again, my point is, how do you know if the wife doesn't agree? Because many of these women won't be public about it. But he says, if the wife doesn't agree, then the husband is these are very strong words. He's a robber. He's literally a robber. He's oppressing his wife. He's a thief because he steals what is due to his wife. He's oppressing her. Not only that, he says he is killing the wife. Can't get stronger language in a rabbinic letter than that. And this is killing the wife. For as is known, the main hope of a wife is that her husband loves her. And when she sees that this is not the case, it is close to a matter of life and death from the great pain and distress she feels in her loneliness as a living widow. Stipler is attacking these so-called holy people because they're turning their wives into living widows. Basically, living in a... She has no relationship with her husband, no physical relationship, and truthfully, these people, they strive really to have no relationship with their wives. The talking is very little. I mean, that's, it's a very different type of relationship. Apparently, they don't pass anything to each other ever. Very strange, unusual stuff. So the Stipler is very harsh in his criticisms of this. He also strongly criticizes the ascetic impulse, which will allow the man. The man has to fulfill his marital duty because he needs to have children, but yet he's not doing anything for the wife here. So in that sense, he's not just killing the wife, he's being selfish. He thinks he's being pious and holy to fulfill the mitzvah, but really it turns out in the end, he's just being completely selfish. So the sniper wants nothing to do with this and sees it as a terrible lifestyle, and I have no doubt that the stifler would agree that these women who are agreeing to this, they're really not agreeing. At the end of the day, if you do have, I mean, women who agree, it's their free choice, even if you think they're misguided. And if you look in the response, I can send anyone who's interested. This has never been published, but I have a copy of about a 10-page privately circulated, among the Gerach Hasidim, privately circulated, typed, 10-page typed defense of the Gerach lifestyle, and it comes down to things such as, like, are women agree on this, and then when the women get married, they know what they're getting themselves into, so you can't come after a year and say, wait a second, you know, this isn't what I bought into here, because the women knew what they were getting into, although, I don't know how much they actually know. I mean, sex education is not something that's really taught there. But in any event, the rabbi, who's one of the big rabbis of Ger, says they know enough to know what they're getting themselves into, and therefore, apparently, even if the wife doesn't agree to it, it doesn't really matter, because she agreed by getting married. She agreed. She's part of this community. And it goes on for pages and pages. And that became a very important letter. This was spread around. After it's published, it's spread around. And it offers, most people listening would say, a healthy attitude toward these issues. But it's worth noting and knowing that in the Jewish world, in the Orthodox world, that is, you have, as in all sorts of areas, we saw that the stifler was extreme in certain areas. The Gerach Hasidim are extreme in other areas. The Gerach Hasidim, I have cousins who are Gerach Hasidim. I used to, when I was in Israel 25 years ago, I'd go for them for Shabbos. And in some of the areas that the stifler we saw was so extreme, the Gerach Hasidim are just the opposite. On the other hand, these areas as well. But this became a very important aspect of the stifler's legacy in that I don't think others would have maybe spoken out so publicly, and the stifler felt that this is something he needed to do. I haven't, by the way, in these discussions with the stifler, I haven't dealt with his personality. I really kept my focus on the more public side. Personality was an interesting thing as well. You can ask people who used to go see him. I mean, sometimes he would literally chase people out of his house if he thought they were wasting his time. If you want to get like a psychological portrait, you can look at the 5 volumes of this Orchot Rabbeinu, and you could see all sorts of interesting examples of it. I'll just give you one, which again shows the distance, perhaps, between someone, not just someone like the stifler, but this is at rabbinic, the world of rabbinic elite, and the way we grow up. The stifler never kissed his grandchildren. This characteristic, which people listening will say that this is so far from contemporary mores, it's also found among other great Torah scholars. Rabbi Soloveitchik writes that he was never kissed by his father. And Rabbi Soloveitchik never kissed his grandchildren. You have this, I'm not saying that the masses weren't like this, and many great Torah scholars are not like this at all. They were full of kisses for their grandchildren. But you do have a certain model of the rabbinic elite, especially the Lithuanian rabbinic elite, that I don't know how to put this. Some of you will say that they're emotionally stunted. Others will say that it's a high level. I don't know what to say about it. I'm just telling you that's the way it is. That I don't know how some of these children grow up. I'm sure it's very hurtful for some of them. But you have, Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote about this, that he was never kissed by his father, or never hugged by his father, never. And he then carried on this tradition. One of his grandchildren wrote about how this was the relationship. So there is a sense, there's plenty of love. There's plenty of love in the Soloveitchik family. There's plenty of love in these other Lithuanian families. But emotionally, the emotion, it's almost like Spock, that the emotions were never let out. They were always kept in. And by the way, this isn't the case for Reb Chaim. Reb Chaim was a very emotional person. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, but Reb Moshe Soloveitchik was very emotionally reserved. We saw Rav Yoshev, and I can give you numerous examples of great Lithuanian Torah scholars who have this almost Spock-like characteristic of overcoming any form of emotion. I guess you could call it the anti-Hasidic approach. Yes, Rabbi Ovadia, you were not. Please listen to my classes last semester. I'm not sure which one it's in. In one of them, I devoted about a half hour to Rav Yoshev, how he's portrayed in Hashakdan. So we went into that in great detail, but Shkoyach on that. That's exactly the portrayal, that no relationship with his grandchildren, and that created controversy. I talked about how the family, some members of the family at least, liked the portrayal, and other members came out against this book. But it's not the only example. We have other examples also of this, and yet we have examples of great Torah sages who were just the opposite. When you say it's a Jewish European thing or a Western European child raising Mishigas, we're not talking about Western Europe. Lithuania is not is Eastern Europe. I think it's a product of a certain Shiva mentality in which Torah study became Torah study above all else led to a dulling of emotions among many. The Rugachever, who we'll get to, was obviously not one in control of his emotions. He was very vibrant and wild and excitable. But you do have, I mean, Spock is the only example I can give to parallel it. The stories we have among certain sages are just, from our perspective, are shocking. Rav Soloveitchik tells these stories, and some of them are so shocking that Moshe Sokol, and he wrote this essay with David Singer about Halachic Man, and he claims that, both of them claim, that really Rabbi Soloveitchik is actually mocking his family by these stories, because these stories are just so crazy. But that is such a distortion. Rabbi Soloveitchik's family was everything to him. And to say that when he records these stories, for example, that famous one, Tekiyas HaShofar, in Haslovich, where the Chabadnik is crying before he blows the shofar, and Ramosha Soloveitchik rebukes him, asking him, do you cry before other mitzvos? I mean, what's this crying? Even Rav Lichtenstein said that this was, quote, over the top. But Ramosha Soloveitchik's point was, do you cry if, let's say, if you tovel a dish in a mikvah? No, so then why are you crying before the Kiyas Shofar? He tells other stories there about the other side of the family, Rav Zila. How his other grandfather, full name, someone help me out here, Ritzilov, who's the other grandfather, the full name, Bill's going to help me out here, Rav Eliyahu of Prizhan, Rav Feinstein, that when his daughter was near death, he told them, tell me when she's about to die so I can take off my tefillin. He wears tefillin all day, and I can go in and be with her as she dies, because he doesn't want to be in there with his tefillin. I mean, these are stories that the mind struggles to wrap itself around, these stories, and these are not just great intellects, but great pious people. I think what we need to do is put ourselves in a different mindset that different people, if for someone to do this in this generation would be completely out of whack, at least in most of our circles, but in different generations, and I think even in certain Haredi circles, this would not be seen as so strange. This book came out recently about this Chinese woman and the way she raises, she believes in raising children. People in America will think that's crazy, that's child abuse, and yet that's the way they do in China, and Chinese kids grow up to be productive and good citizens, etc. So these are just psychologically different approaches based on different cultures, where you grew up, and the things that are unimaginable to us, our lifestyle, our way of doing things, can be unimaginable for them. I have about three different stories of Gedolim whose relatives died on Shabbos, close relatives, and they refused to cry or anything like that because they said, It's a holiday, or Shabbos, there's no mourning here. The Brisker Rav had a child who died before 30 days, and his wife was crying, and he rebuked his wife, saying there's no mourning for 30 days. So there's no avelos. Therefore, how can you cry? Crying has to be connected to avelos. Again, the Briskers are known for these sorts of stories, but
to you. Let me look at some of these questions here.
Can these stories be traced to the Talmudic era? Yes, they can. Yeah, when I dealt with the Shakdam that Avadia mentioned, someone sent me in an example. Actually, it was Avadia's brother, Rabbi Dovi Hoffman, sent me examples of from the Talmudic era. You have certain examples like this from the Talmudic era and various stories. On the other hand, you have just the opposite also. The good thing about the Talmud is you have all different models. You have excitement, you have emotion, and then you have, in fact, there's one story. It's quite shocking, at least the way most people understand it, that someone died. There's a story in there about one of the, I forget which one, he went to visit someone who was sitting Shiva, and he came in and he said to them, basically, you shouldn't, don't have to feel so bad, because, and he told him all the people who he lost, I think 9 children or something, maybe someone will remind me the details, that he has sat Shiva for us. But really, truthfully, I heard a way of explaining this, that he wasn't trying to say to them that your pain is not significant, because I've been through a lot more. I think the meaning of this story is that, I heard this from like Steve Blanchard, that just like I was able to bring myself up and begin life anew after losing so much, you should know that you've only lost 1, I lost 9, and I was able to come back and live my life. You too will be able to live your life. But there's no question you have stories in the Talmud and Rashic literature that show you this model as well. Yeah, but Bill asks, the story about Revelia is not quite as harsh, but more disciplined. That is true. On the other hand, for many people today, you know, your kid is dying. The very idea that, that you know, this would be your major concern with Philin and everything, that would find them strange. But okay, different people. The Vilna Gaon, it told, in the introduction to this, his parish on the Shulchan Aruch, his sons speak about how he went off into the woods, he used to go off sometimes to be by himself, and he forgot that he had a child, deathly ill, and he was out there for 2 weeks. Rabbi Zilberstein, in one of his books, mentions that the Nesivos, Yaakov Avrisa, his name was the same as his father's name, or his son's name was the same as his name, I forget which one, because when it came time to name the child, the father was so involved in his learning, and here is at the naming, at the bris, and he thought they were asking him his name, so they said he gave him his own name. And he brings another story there, Rabbi Zilberstein, that's Rav Yashiv's son-in-law. I forget the story. I'll bring the story in next class. Another one of these stories that... I forget the story, but a contemporary story. And truthfully, as Rabbi Yonasan Rossman, who sent this to me, commented, it's not important whether it's true or not. The importance is that these are the stories that are told and are looked up to. When I was in yeshiva, the Rebbe told us that at the Stipor's wedding, he was learning. At his wedding. So it's just a different psychology. Let me see here. Ovadia, grandson of... I'm going to read it out loud because people who listen on later asked me to read it out loud. A grandson of Chaim Konevsky described to me how the grandfather sits at a Shabbos table schmoozing with his different grandchildren to come to eat the meal with him. Now I doubt his father acted in that opposite extreme. No. It says that the Stipor actually used, the Stipor is not the same as Revel Yashiv. Yashiv, the book describes that he doesn't have any real relationship with the grandchildren. The Stipor, the book, Archos Rabbeinu describes how his grandchildren come, he gave them candies and things like that. So he is not one of these Spock-like figures. But he, in terms of kissing, and in that way, he doesn't do that, it's described. So he, I guess, would stay in the middle. Rabbi Soloveitchik used to talk to his grandchildren about the baseball games. It's known that he would ask the people in his shul in Boston to tell him how the Red Sox were doing, to explain to him, you know, who's on which team. So he had something to talk to his grandchildren about. In fact, even after he had grandchildren living in Israel, he would send them messages if the Red Sox did well. So I didn't mean to imply that the Stipor or Rabbi Soloveitchik were at the extreme that you see with Rav Yashiv and others, or the people that Rabbi Soloveitchik describes. However, they, both of them talk about not... kissing their not being kissed by their father, or they didn't kiss their grandchildren. Rabbi Soloveitchik himself acknowledged that he was not able to live up to some of this element. he describes how the Briscoes would never go to cemeteries. They didn't go to cemeteries for all sorts of reasons. The Rambam says not to go, and I think the reason that at least Rabbi Soloveitchik understands it is at least partly that it moves your emotions in a place they shouldn't be. And he describes, though, that as the Rav describes, that he followed this his whole life until his wife died, and then emotionally the pull was too strong. So he did go to the cemetery. And I think if you read the way he describes it, you're supposed to think that he's weak, and that's why he goes to the cemetery. But if he was strong, like his father and grandfather, then he wouldn't go to the cemetery, because really you're not supposed to go to cemeteries. If you watch the video, I just got this video. You can see it. Someone uploaded it illegally. There's a movie came out last year about Rabbi Kafach, put out by his granddaughter. It deals with the dispute in Yemen, the great dispute. And I wanted to show it on Pesach. I'm going to be at this hotel, scholar in residence. So one of the evenings I wanted to show it. And I also wanted to show it at a shul. I was in Chicago 2 weeks ago. So they wanted to have a program Saturday night with me, so I said, a great idea, I'll show the movie. The movie is about an hour. And then afterwards, I'll talk a bit about who Rabbi Kafach was. But they told me, I saw on the, when I ordered the movie for $25, I got it, it said on it to show a screening, I have to contact them. And they told me it's $22 to screen. So I can't screen it because they're not going to pay $250. But I see that someone illegally put it on YouTube. If you go there, right, part one, and I can send the link if anyone's interested, Hebrew, although the one I have also has English subtitles, it begins with Rabbi Kafach's wife visiting his grave at the cemetery, and she's telling her granddaughter that her husband, the Rabbi Kafach, told her never to come to the cemetery. We don't go to cemeteries. And that's what the Rambam said. Glenn wants to know if there's non-Jewish ideas here. I don't think so. I don't think so. There's Jewish ideas. Every non-Jewish idea, you can find a parallel to Jewish ideas. I'm talking about internal Jewish ideas. Bill says, Rav Elia wanted to put on tefillin and wanted to make sure he could do so before entering the room as she died. I understood. But the sense you get from reading it, if I'm not mistaken, is that... their life was completely halachic, completely structured, and most people see this as putting the emphasis in the wrong place. I think. Ravadia says, Ravisa Zilberstein says, over when news of Rav Yosha's daughter's death reached him, he promptly closed the sefer he was learning and went to pull out a Shulchan Aruch Yarede Hochos Avegos. That's in the the Shakdan also. That immediately he knew that he was soon going to be an Avel, because first you have to have his funeral and everything. Still learn, and he went and he started learning the laws of Avelos. That's the sort of story that some people in the family were upset with, I think, because you think that your child dies, you should start crying. Not all of a sudden pick up a different sefer. So no one has yet written about the study of the model of the Lithuanian scholar. As I said, there's certainly this Spock like an approach in which you are master of your emotions to such an extreme. And I would like to know children of some of these Gedolim who had that aspect, how it affected him, how it affected them. Hook was very different, of course. All the Hasidic-oriented sages are different. Let us move on. I want to now discuss a couple other things. By the way, I'm happy to move on, but sometimes I think in this area people are finding it interesting. But thank you for trying to keep the conversation online. I'm going to show you a few other things which are not so important, but they show us something about the type, or just his attitude as well. There is an entire book between... Stipler and this Rabbi Menashe Klein. I'm going to show you a picture now, which was sent to me by Shlomo. Right there, that's Menashe Klein in the middle of the Stipler. Apparently, that's when he came and brought him the Strimal. They respected each other a great deal. What's the going on here? Well, first, a little bit about who Rabbi Menashe Klein is. a genius, no question about it. A genius, an incredibly learned person, but probably the most extreme and fanatical of anyone writing halacha today, comes from Hungary. The area of Hungary technically was Czechoslovakia. Find in his writings some of the most extreme things imaginable and some quite liberal things. As I said, I gave this talk in Budapest last year on him, and if I ever write it up, my point will be as follows, that Menashe Klein wants to recreate the way things were done in Hungary, tradition. And therefore, he has real problems with Haredi Judaism today. Because Haredi Judaism is really this newfangled religion in which has been influenced by modernity and feminism, and they do... For example, Haredi Judaism, you have all these women shiurim by women for women, even by men for men, and it's a big thing. Just open up any Haredi newspaper, special classes for the women. The modern Orthodox have classes for men and women, and the Haredim just have classes for women. Menashe Klein writes, what's going on here? Who ever heard in the old country of women shiurim? He thinks this is terrible. And it's also Bittul Torah, because if the woman goes out, then the man has to stay home and watch the children. So no, the women should be like they've been in the past. They stay home and the man goes learn. The fact that women today are involved in learning and all that, that's an example of how Haredi Judaism is a sort of like a reform type of Judaism, but from the Orthodox side. It's Orthodox reformism. And Menashe Klein's Judaism is not orthodoxy, really. It's traditional Judaism. And you see this over and over again. And this is part of the dispute I'm going to speak about. The Haredim come up with all these new ideas that he says, we never did this in the old country. The Shabbos is a perfect example. Everyone takes their wives, they all come, they go to hear Parshas Zachar. Because it's a positive commandment from the Torah, hear about Amalek. So everyone knows that this is a big time we have to listen to the reading of the Torah. And yet, all the authorities are clear that women are not obligated to hear it. That is the early authorities, because it's a positive time-bound commandment. The first one to say that women should hear Parshas Zachar is Rabbi Nassan Adler, who I see will not get to him today. We'll certainly get to him next class, the Chasam Sofer's teacher. And it took off. That's maybe the only thing of his that took off. And today, everyone does it. At least I shouldn't say everyone does, but I can't speak for all the Haredi shuls, but it is very popular in the modern Orthodox world, it's standard, and it's very popular in the Haredi world. Please let me know if any of you in your shuls, if you know Haredi shuls that don't do it, let me know. Menashe Klein, this is crazy. Because this is an American thing, basically, that all the women do it in the Haredi world and in the right-wing Orthodox. He says, in Hungary, the women never came to shul. Women don't have to hear Parshas Zachar. If you tell the women they have to come to shul, this is a reform. This is an influence of feminism, and the women want to be involved in this, and that's not the woman's place. The woman doesn't go to shul. The woman's not obligated. She has to obligate to her Megillah. That's what she hears. She's not obligated to hear Parshas Zachar. So from Menashe Klein's perspective, women going to shul to hear Parshas Zachar, don't tell me you're Menashe Adler, he's not accepted. This is a reform. Obviously, it's a reform with a small r, but it's a reform. This is orthodoxy, but this is not traditional Judaism. Traditional Judaism, women never went. It was never the custom in Lithuania for women to go or any of these places. By the way, I have a little booklet here called Halachic Reflections on Purim. This was sent to me also. It's a pre-publication chapter from the Sefer Ma'oros Moshe, Volume 2, which is going to have Ramosha Feinstein's halachic positions. And Moshe Feinstein is very far removed from Menashe Klein, but look what it says in here. There are kehilot that organize special kriyas for women. Ramosha felt that this was against halacha for several reasons. He's speaking about Shabbos Parshas Zachar. Firstly, it was against standard Minhag Yisrael. People today don't realize Minhag Yisrael come to shul to hear this. Secondly, if women are not obligated to hear the Parsha, why would one innovate a special kriya for them? I shul, for example, at the end of davening, they do a special kriya. Thirdly, it is problematic to have a kriya berabim, that is a public recitation, without brachot and without three aliyos. Fourthly, it isn't recorded that it is permitted to originate a kriya. My grand And he says, my grandfather, this is talking about Moshe, said, if a shul prefers, they can combine the kriya of Parsha Zohar with the Mincha kriya. So there's an example. So what's one of the things that was very valued in Eastern Europe? Hijos. Who you married. That was a big deal. Who you were descended from. Not such a big deal today. I think even in the Lithuanian world, if you're a Rosh Yeshiva, then it's important, I guess, maybe for your child to marry another Rosh Yeshiva's kid. But in general, and I've asked plenty of people in the Lithuanian world, I wrote about this a bit, and I asked some people from Lakewood, and they said, Yichus really is not taken that seriously anymore. It doesn't matter where you come from. If you're a good learner, that's what people are interested in. But Yichus was a big deal. So already you see that there's going to be a problem with the way Haredi Orthodoxy today functions. And by the way, this affects some Menashe Klein in different ways as well. Converts. Our world, obviously, a convert is like every other Jew, but for Menashe Klein, he's halachically like every other Jew, but there's no Yichus there, so don't marry him. So here we have a problem with Balei Tshuva. First of all, you have a general problem, and then you have a more, I guess, a quasi halachic, or not halachic, but more of a hashkafic type of problem. The first is, a Baal Tshuva has no Yichus. So therefore, according to Rav Menashe Klein, we should not be marrying Baalei Tshuva. And then there's a more technical problem here that already the early sources speak about, that children conceived when there's no Tara Samishpacha, that there's some element, a metaphysical element that is problematic. It's not a halachic issue, but it's something that is with them. So therefore, obviously, this is going to create a kess. If this was the situation, you can never have a kiruv movement. You could, but it would be a kess system. No one's going to become religious if all of a sudden then you're in a kess system, although you do have some of this in the Haredi world, that people don't necessarily want to marry Baalei Tshuva, but you have plenty who do marry them, and you don't have this kess system. Well, the Stipler and the many others are Binyamin Zilber, and yeah, the whole host, basically the entire Lithuanian Torah world, came to the conclusion, both for practical and also textual reasons, that this is not a concern, that first of all, we're not interested in the caste system, and Binyamin Zilber says this explicitly in a letter from Menashe Klein, we have to bring everyone closer. And second of all, when you see someone who's a Baal Tshuva, that any negative influence that maybe was on him from his parents, grandparents, or anything, has obviously been overcome. And as far as the Stipler is concerned, that puts an end to this whole thing. And these are not issues we need to be concerned with. But the Menashe Klein disagrees. And you have a whole book, not a big book, but a little book of their back and forth. They had great respect for one another. But Rabbi Menashe Klein really, there's no change in his worldview. The Stipler recognizes we have an amazing generation where up until this recent generation, it was always Orthodox Jews, traditional Jews going out. And now we have a phenomenon where people wanted to come in, and you're going to tell them then that we have a caste system, we don't want to marry with you, we want to keep you separate. It's inconceivable for all sorts of reasons. But Rav Menashe Klein, his attitude is, in Europe, there's Yichus, we wouldn't want to mix with these people. So you see the Stipler becoming the leading advocate of the new type of society the Haredi Judaism has created. An open society, a welcoming society. And Rav Menashe Klein, with the old values of Yichus, everything, women and converts and Baalei Tshuva, everything on his perspective, non-Jews, they're all like of a lower caliber. Not halachically, but hashkafically. It's so strange when you read Menashe Klein because he's trying to transport an attitude, not a halachic attitude, but a sort of a cultural attitude of Hungary 100 years ago and 200 years ago and try to put it in the United States in the 21st century. And the results are disastrous when you see how he thinks people should live, their neighbors, with their other Jews, even with other Jews. And the Stipler recognized this. We conclude, just a couple more points by mentioning. First of all, the Stipler's son. Stipler's son
has followed him in many ways, a great authority, much, the Cypher's son today, Chaim Konevsky, has much wider knowledge, and that Chaim Konevsky, he reads much wider. That is, the Cypher had a very limited library, if you put it, want to put it that way. Talmud, Rambam, but the Stipler basically, the Stipler's son, Rav Chaim Konevsky, basically knows everything. All the different Midrashim and various texts, so in that sense they're different. But much like the Stipler became a miracle worker by the end of his life, a very saintly figure, the Stipler's son as well. And I showed you this a couple semesters ago. Here you see a picture of the Stipler's son, holy wine. Are producing wine. I cannot tell you whether the Stipler's son had anything to do with this wine, whether he touched it, I have no idea. The point is that people feel that if they produce this wine and say that it has something to do with the Rav Chaim Konevsky, people will buy it. If you tried this shtick in Lithuania, they'd throw you out of the base medrash. But you see here already the idea that Stipler and his family, Rav Chaim Konevsky, is a different type of Torah sage. Says you can get miracles by drinking this wine. The Sephardim would do this sort of thing. This is, the Moroccans would do this, but for a Lithuanian Torah scholar, and I'm assuming he has nothing to do with this, but to associate his name with this is quite significant. Someone emails me privately that there is a caste system in the yeshiva world that Jews of color are not allowed to marry into communities, and that even the person spoke to Rav Shach about this, and that, yes, you do have a caste system, but that's just racism. When you have, let's speak about whites. When you have just another Jew who's white, and let's say you don't want to have anything to do with him because of their background, that would create a complete caste system, as it would with conversion. What you're just reflecting is simply racist sentiments, and it's not advocated anywhere, by the way. Even Menashe Klein, you don't find any racism in his... Because anyone who's enough of a scholar knows that racism is not found in our sources. It is cultural, no question about it, but if you're a Torah scholar, you know that there's no difference between a convert of... this race or that race. So Menashe Klein's position is simply about Yichus. But, I mean, you don't need to speak about blacks and whites here. The yeshiva world has a caste system against the Sephardim. The Sephardim are not regarded as equivalent. So I'll be the last one to deny that there's problems in the yeshiva world. There's loads of problems in the yeshiva world. But what Stipler was saying, he wasn't dealing with those problems. The Stipler, though, and Rav Shach, both of them, were leading advocates for the Sephardic children. I'm going to read you a letter in a minute about the Stipler, how really, when it's important, he says, people choose their own Das Torah. The fact that Rav Shach and the Stipler would order these principals of schools to allow Sephardic kids in, and the principals refused to allow them in, even when they were told to, shows you that Das Torah only goes so far. They would say things like, well, I know what the Stipler said, or Rav Shach said, but the parents won't allow it, etc., etc. There is, the yeshivas are full of anti-Sephardic sentiment, and that's the main type of anti-sentiment, is anti-Sephardic sentiment. We saw examples of this last year. They actually built a wall, a fence, between the Ashkenazim and Sephardim, and this is a continuing problem. Someone emails me that... the Stipler's library was vast in comparison to the Rebbe's. Yeah, I mean, the Stipler does quote, he'll quote Tshuvas occasionally, but if you can compare the things that he studied, I don't get the sense that he thought it was important to study the things that Rav Chaim Konevsky studies. Rav Chaim Konevsky is a master in all sorts of arcane areas that traditional Lithuanian Torah scholars don't go near. Okay, Bill, you're right, is the ruling on donating blood. You have... It's a strange combination of cultural biases, of halachic extremism. There's a lot that can be said about it. Let us go on. We have a few more minutes. I just want to call a few other tidbits from the Stipler, maybe just 5 minutes. Or For those who want to check, it's in Carjana de Garta. I have it here. Volume 1, pages 221 to 222, where the Slifer shows nice insight. He says he's responding to for the Satmar types who said that they were upset that he's opposing them, their version of Das Torah, and when it came to the state of Israel. And the Stipler says, what are you getting so upset about? At the end of the day, people are going to do what they want to do. And he says, in my opinion, even if the head of the Eda Haredit, the right-wing, you know, the anti-Zionist groups, if they were to say tomorrow, Shemitzah Latzbia, that if, let's say the Satmar tomorrow came out, the Rebbe, and said, it's an obligation to vote in Israeli elections. What does he say? He said, how you take it, Poser Beit HaTzedek? Immediately they would postle the Beit HaTzedek, and they wouldn't listen to it. Because Kol Echad Nechad, everyone's so mechama shabar b'einav atzmo. Everyone does what they think is correct. I've said this already, that this the idea of Das Torah is in large measure a fiction, a fraud. Because if Rav Yoshev tomorrow were to declare that you have to say Halal on Yom Ha'atzmaut, would they start saying Halal on Yom Ha'atzmaut? Of course not. They would say that he's not an authentic transmitter of Das Torah, even though he wasn't until now. Certain ideologies have become mainstream in the Haredi world, and therefore, to become a Haredi Gadol, first you have to advocate these ideologies, and the people will determine, the masses, or the Askanim, the bigwigs, will determine. They're the kingmakers. They make and break the Gadolim. If they like what you say, they make you one of their sages. They build you up and make you Maran and put you at the top. But if you turn on them, if you start putting forth ideas that they don't like, well, then they'll break you. Say you're no longer one of them. You're not. You're no longer the one they go to. So there's this weird combination. The Gadol in the Haredi world has Das Torah to a limited extent. He can maneuver within certain limits. That is, Rav Yoshev was able to say that now we have to get our people in the Beis Din, as opposed to boycott. But if he were to go much further in the direction of the state, then people would start questioning him, would start wondering, is he really the authentic authority or not? And that's exactly what the Stipler is saying here, that at the end of the day, you don't need to worry about me, that people are going to listen to me, because people are going to listen to what they're convinced, and they find a Gadol that has that position, and if the Gadol then changes his perspective, they'll find a different person. You can find numerous examples of this. What else do I want to tell you? Interesting position of the Stipler. Believe it or not, the Stipler thinks that for certain special people, it's okay to follow the Ramban's unusual view that you don't need to go to a doctor. Ramban thinks that certain people can just totally rely, Christian Science, can totally rely on prayer. The Stipler thinks that even in today's day and age, there's room for such a position, for people to follow this. So the Rabbi Soloveitchik quote is quoted in the book put out by David Holzer last year as saying, Rav Lichtenstein, in another place, quotes Rabbi Soloveitchik as either saying himself or quoting his grandfather that they don't believe the Ramban could have said this. I can't imagine that he said this seriously because it's in the parish. But his point, I think, or maybe he did mean it, I don't know, but that just shows you how unusual a position this is. Finally, almost finally, the Stipler opposed the publication of the Chazon Ish's criticisms on the Chaim Soloveitchik. Not because of the riskers. They opposed it because they say that the Chazon Ish never really would have wanted it to be published. No, the Stipler's attitude is that these were just private notes, and that when you read them and you read Reb Chaim, think, if this is this the best the Chazon Ish could offer? It's obvious that the Chazon Ish loses this debate, according to the Stipler. And really, had the Chazon Ish been able to develop his ideas in greater length, as opposed to just notes almost to himself, you would see really what the Chazon Ish is getting at. So by publishing these notes, you're not really getting the measure of the Chazon Ish's criticisms of the Stipler. Finally, Upsharon. Let me talk about Upsharon for 1 minute. Some of you listening now are in the Haredi world, so you can tell me. It used to be the case, maybe it's changed, that no one from a Lithuanian background would ever have this ceremony where the three-year-old kid has his hair cut. This is a Hasidic thing. It doesn't go back very far. It's a few hundred years. You have stories about the Ari, you have Sephardim who do it, or standard among Sephardim. If you want to get details, in Arabic they call it a halak, I think you can Sperber in volume 8. He has all the halakhic writings, and halakhic in quotes, and the writings of Minhag, and also the other literature. It seems to be a good deal of evidence that this is actually comes from non-Jewish practices. You have Arabs who are doing things like this. He even quotes someone in here who acknowledges it probably comes from a non-Jewish source, but how we kosher basically these things and make them holy. In any event, it became a standard practice in the Hasidic world, and it seems that in the last 10 years, it's become popular in the modern Orthodox world. When I say popular, I don't mean popular like Bar and Bat Mitzvahs are popular, but at least in my town, every year I'll hear of two or three. I'll see kids sometimes with long hair, and I'm told that in places like Woodmere, it's much more common. And many of these people will say that, although they're not Hasidic today, that they come from Hasidic stock. Look, any of us come from Poland. Great-grandparents come from Poland. Odds are we're from Hasidic stock. But years ago, just because you were from Hasidic stock, no one would. I was growing up, my whole town is full of people from Hasidic stock. No one would do this. So I think part of it has to do with that. It's a good chance for a party. It's fun. You get to cut the kids' hair. The modern Orthodox are always in for a party. Invite the modern Orthodox to come out one night to have a class, serious learning. That's hard. That's hard to fill up a room. But invite the modern Orthodox to come out for good food, and maybe you'll get a divrei dvar Torah. That they're usually up to. As I said many times, modern Orthodoxy, to a large extent, is a lifestyle. It's a life choice, a lifestyle, as opposed to an ideological decision. Which is fine also for those people. And not everyone, if all you had was the Haredi type or the serious modern Orthodox type, what about 90% of the world who wants to keep kosher and Shabbos and everything, but can't live that sort of intense learning lifestyle? They'd have nowhere to go. So it's good that you have a place for everyone. So the modern Orthodox in recent years, it's become very popular. There's a famous story where the Brisker Rav was asked. Someone came to him with his kid and asked the Brisker Rav to cut the kid's hair. The first cut, I guess it's a big zechus to do that. Brisker Rav, in classic Brisker Rav fashion, refused and said, "I am not a barber." Showing that this is not something, not just something we don't do, but this is something we don't like. For whatever reason, the Brisker Rav thought it. If you think in terms of brisk, you could see it very clearly. Brisk, all minhagim and brisk have to have a halachic basis. What is this new minhag from a few hundred years ago? Where is the halachic basis in this? Why are you wasting my time cutting hair? I mean, you could think of any number of reasons why the Brisker Rav would respond this way, and that's the Brisker Rav. However, we're told in Orchos Rabbeinu, page number here, check it, it's Panine Rabbeinu Akilas Yaakov, volume 1, pages 22-23. So the stipor is asked, well, he cut a kid's hair. And he replied, just like I said, he said, when they asked the Brisker Rav this, he said he's not a barber. Stipor was adopting the Brisker Rav's position, his intolerance, saying, I'm not going to be bothered with this practice. But the stipor is not the Brisker Rav, because the book describes how the stipor later regretted speaking this way. And that he said, why? He said, well, the guy comes to me, he wants me to cut his hair. I need to tell him what the Brisker Rav said. What does the Brisker Rav have to do with him? And it hurt his feelings. I shouldn't have spoken that way. And what's the big deal, he says, to cut the hair? I should have taken the scissors and cut the hair. So I think that's interesting that you see the difference. The stipler, his immediate reaction was to say, this is not our approach. Don't give me this nonsense cutting hair. But then later he regretted it, because he's not the Brisker Rav, and the Brisker Rav could do things that only the Brisker Rav could do. And he realized it was a mistake, and he hurt the person's feelings, and he apologized. Look, the Brisker Rav, not the Brisker Rav, the stipler on Nittel on Christmas Eve would not learn publicly. And privately he would, because he didn't want the Hasidim to feel offended, because here if the great stipler is learning, it shows that he disrespects their practice. Even though in all the Lithuanian yeshivas, they're sitting and learning, and the Brisker Rav, you think the Brisker Rav cared what the Hasidim are doing, and what the Hasidim would think? He'd think this is a nonsense custom, and he'd learn publicly from the rooftops. But it says the stipler was sensitive. He didn't want to hurt their feelings, make them think that he didn't respect them, so he would only learn privately. A different mentality. Okay, with this, I'm going to end the stipler. Let me just get some questions here. I didn't have time to get to the comments and questions you sent me, so at the beginning of next class, before we start with the Chasam Sofer, I will get to that. Chasam Sofer is going to take us, more than a few weeks. So let me quick answer some questions here or comments. Chaim, you say Shalom Zachar. I don't know what that means. You're saying as a new practice, as a new custom? Yes, Bill Gewertz, present company excluded. Anyone who's willing Monday night to come and listen to what we talk about and deal with, stories about great Torah sages and learning and everything, obviously is excluded. The truth is the modern Orthodox community is, what I said, it's very easy to be negative. Say they don't take learning seriously, and many don't. However, many of the children of these people do. These are people who are still committed to yeshivas and shuls. So their children can rise above, and they're usually very proud of that. And also, it is very important. I'm not going to deny, for example, that for most modern Orthodox, what it means is, the fact what's important in life is that Shea Stadium is now serving Glock Kosher hot dogs or Duggies. But for many people in the Haredi world also, it's a lifestyle. Even probably for most people, it's a lifestyle. The average person can't live intellectual, can't live this way, so it's a lifestyle. I think in certain aspects, the modern Orthodox lifestyle is pagan. Their culture is very similar to Western secular culture. And in that sense, the more the right-wing Orthodox have advantage. On the other hand, there are certain aspects of modern Orthodox life which have advantages over the Haredi world. Anyone will deny or argue with me when I say in terms of Dina de Mahusadina, government compliance, all sorts of things, the modern Orthodox stand above them. I'm talking about the people, just the lifestyle people, the people who basically do the most important stuff. They observe Torah and mitzvot. And at the end of the day, how can you criticize when you look at 90% of the people who don't keep kosher, don't do anything, and their children are going to intermarry, and here you have people who observe Torah and mitzvot. It's very hard to criticize them, even though rabbis do, but I mean, things in perspective. So each community has its strength, and each community has its weaknesses. And you look at that 40 years ago, you didn't have any strong modern Orthodox yeshivas, religious Zionist yeshivas. All you had were the yeshivas in the Haredi world. And look today, you have great yeshivas, Haaretz Zion, Mali Adumi, Merkaz Harav, which are the equal. And then the other yeshivas, Kotel, etc., which are the equal of any of the Haredi yeshivas in terms of quality of learning, if not in quantity yet, you can see that the modern Orthodox world has come a long way, and it's really not where you are that's important, but are you going up or are you going down? And if you just look at where the religious Zionist world has gone in the last 40 years, even in these areas thought to be the base of the Haredi, the focus on Torah study, you see that the religious Zionist world has been moving up, and it continues to move up. Some more questions here. Shalom Zachar. Yeah, I don't know the history, actually, of Shalom Zachar. When it dates from. I'd have to look into that. And then you have the Simchat Bat, which is even newer. I'm asked, what does the Kilos Yaakov cover? It's a commentary on the Gemara. It used to not be available publicly. That is, you had to go buy it individually from the stipler. He would actually speak to you usually a bit if he was there. They used to say when I was in yeshiva, that was because he would only sell it to people who were really going to learn it, not people who just put it on their bookshelf to as like a coffee table book to show that, hey, I went to the Stipler and I picked this book up. I don't think that's the case. At least I was told by Shlomo Tikashinsky, Rabbi Dr. Shlomo Tikashinsky, who knows this world very well, is from this world. He just wrote his doctorate on the Slobodka Yeshiva in the interwar years. He's someone who comes, he was a Rosh Kollel, and now has moved into the more the academic world. He runs the Lander College for Haredim in Israel today. He told me that the real reason was that the Stipler, these were very poor people, the Stipler, just like the Chazon Ish, and he survived on selling the books, and this gave him the chance to make a little income cutting out the middlemen. At least that's what he told me. I'm asked, will I be discussing Rav Meir Simcha the next semester? No, I have Rav Meir Simcha. I have basically it all prepared. But because hope is that I will be taking this group to Europe in the summer, out of excitement, people are emailing me all the time about it, but we still need more people to sign up. We do have people signed up, but we need some more to sign up. But I'm confident, look in the Jewish Week, the next 3 weeks, there'll be small ads that we've had in the Jewish press. So we're hoping, so since that is the plan, I am focusing on people who I'm going to be dealing with when I go there. So like two birds with one stone. After all, if I go to a place like Pressburg, I'm going to have to speak about the Chasam Sofer probably for 5 hours. Whole bus trip to Pressburg while we're at the grave, not just the Chasam Sofer, all the people who buried around him. It's an unbelievable kever. The whole cemetery was destroyed, except for the Chasam Sofer and a few other graves, due to millions of dollars of bribery during World War II. They built it, they covered it up and built it underground. I was there when it was before they redid it, and right after communism fell, and I've been there since. So there's a lot to discuss. So therefore, next semester we'll deal with the Chasam Sofer, we're going to deal with the Kassav Sofer, the Chasam Sofer's son, who succeeded him as Rav of Pressburg. If we have another semester before the trip, I want to start looking at some of the rabbis in Prague, the great figures there, all sorts of figures who I have to deal with on the summer trip. But, God willing, when we return and the trip is over, the first one we will deal with will be Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk. Lots of stuff about him. Let's hear. Avadia says there's an interesting connection between the Chasam Sofer and the Stipler, in that the Stipler was of the opinion that one named after the wife of the Chasam Sofer should be named Sarah, contrary to the documented name Sari. And I believe Rav Chaim Konevsky disagrees with his father. Avadia, why would anyone ever name someone after the wife of the Chasam Sofer? It's not like, are there people today in of Hungarian descent that are naming people after the wife of the Chasam Sofer? Chasam Sofer had three wives, incidentally. We'll hear about this next class. I'm not sure even who Sarah is. Is that Rabbi Kiva Eger's daughter, the second wife, or not? In terms of the crazy stories I was telling before, Ramosha Sternbach, in his commentary on Chumash, tells a story how Rabbi Kiva Eger did not know that his daughter died. They didn't tell him, and he decides to come visit. I don't think the story is true at all. But this is the sort of values that are being advocated, or an ethos that you see. He comes to Pressburg on a surprise visit to see the Chasam Sofer, and he comes and he goes to the Beis Din and sees the Chasam Sofer, and they start talking and learning. They go back to the house, Erev Shabbos, they get ready for Shabbos, they continue talking and learning. The whole Shabbos, all they're doing is talking and learning, that Rav Eger never even remembers to mention, never even realizes that he doesn't see his daughter there, and then leaves without asking, where's my daughter? I don't believe the story for a minute. Rabbi Kiva Eger was not that sort of person. It's biography. It's unimaginable that any good old Yisrael could ever be so blind that you're sitting at the whole table the whole Shabbos and you never ask where your kid is. But this story is told, and some people believe it, which shows you that an ethos is created. Bill says the Kilos Yaakov is closer in style to Brisk Light than the Chazon Ish. That's correct. And I told Bill, remember the first class, I think it was, I mentioned that when I was in Cologne, Germany, I was with this person from Kol Chazon Ish, and I couldn't believe it. He was telling me that they don't hold so much of the Stipler. I couldn't believe it because this is the brother-in-law, the successor, as it were. And he said, no, it's his method of learning is not like the Chazon Ish. So they didn't really hold of it. Shlomo says, Tosfos and Bava Kama puts a Shalom Zachar in the Talmudic times. I'd have to look it up, all the different sources, but that obviously puts it much further back. Thank you, Shlomo. Obadiah says that his descendants, many of them, Sarala, they say it's an acronym. Okay. And the Chasam Shofar, as we'll see, has many, many descendants. Seth Farber, follow the Jewish word. He is a direct descendant of the Chasam Shofar. Shlomo asks, which group is larger, Haredim or modern? Modern is larger. Modern is larger in Israel. What do they say Haredim are? 10-11% of Israel, and I say the modern would be 25 maybe, or 20-25. So Haredim are modern or more are larger in Israel, definitely. My sense is that they're larger in America also, but in 20 years they will not be. The modern do pick up from the Haredi. Haredi dropouts often turn to modern dropouts just drop out. The Haredi dropouts, they go a little left. They end up in the modern Orthodox shul. Every modern Orthodox shul has people left the Haredi world. The Satmar dropouts, types like that, they just go crazy totally. They become the other extreme. My sense is that in a good another generation with the birth rate, extreme birth rate, Satmar, 8-9 kids each family. They keep raising that school. They have to expand it every other year. My sense is that the modern will be a minority in another generation in America. Israel, I don't know. I mean, the birth rate is also enormous in Israel, but it's also how you define modern Israel. You have the Sephardic element, which is really closer modern to the religious Zionists. But in England right now, I think in Baltimore, I think the Haredim outnumber. I don't think the Haredim do outnumber in Baltimore. If you look in a place like London, the Haredim outnumber the modern, and that's because many of the moderns have left and gone to Israel, and England is going to be a Haredi... England and all of Europe will be Islamic. Just plug into YouTube Muslim demographics, and you'll see a very scary video talking about what's going to be in another 20, 30 years, how some of these countries are beyond the tipping point. But in terms of Judaism, England's going to be Haredi. France will not, because France is Sephardic. And I think the Haredim, and when I say Haredim, I'm including Satmar. Satmar has very little in common with Lubavitch or with Mary Searle Baltimore, even with Lakewood, parts of Lakewood. But I'm including all of them together. I think that within another generation, the Haredim will be. And the Haredim have something that modern Orthodox don't have. Do you know how many people would become modern Orthodox, who they like the lifestyle, they're attracted to it, and then they see cost of school, of camp, and I'm convinced that that's what keeps so many people. We grew up in it, so we suffer, and we have to do it. But outsiders, they don't have to become, and then they're driven away. I'm convinced that's what, you know, modern Orthodoxy has become, an upper middle class lifestyle. Unlike in Israel. Go to Israel. You have security guards, you have, all sorts of people, wearing yarmulkes. So you don't have to be upper middle class in Israel. It's for all types. In the Haredi world, still being lower middle class, you can be taller. There is room in the Haredi world for all types. So therefore, that gives them entree to different types of Balei Tshuva. And it allows people who don't, many people leave the modern Orthodox world because they don't feel like they can keep up with this rat race. Either they go to Israel or if they stay in America, many people leave because if you're not really middle class or even upper middle class, what community can you live in? It's almost impossible to live in. If you can live in it, who wants to be in a community where you're the poorest and you can't have anything other people have? So many people like that go to Israel, and other people just give it up. It's so modern Orthodoxy has real problems, I think, in terms of continuity. Bill points out that there's two reasons for Shalom Zachar. We'll have to check on that. Yeah, Shuli says it's higher birth rate because of no tuition. There is a higher birth rate, even among the religious Zionists, but the Haredim have a very large birth rate in Israel. I think the statistic is that 25% of all first graders today are Haredi. Again, Haredi, and this includes, I don't know how actually accurate this statistic is, because they're including kids at the Shas school. And if you take the Shas schools, very few of them are actually even Sephardic Haredi. Most of them will go to the army, and I don't think you can really call the followers of Avad Yosef as Haredi. Yate Neman recently, you'll see how they portray Avad Yosef. They're not religious Zionists, but they're close to religious Zionists. Rav Chaim Emsalem was obviously much closer, but even now you have Nissim Zev, you have many of these deputies in the Shas party are really religious Zionists, and the Shas party itself officially joined the World Zionist Organization. So I think the statistics they give these scary statistics that 25% are Haredi, which is scary, obviously, because what is that going to mean? In another 15 years, you're going to 12 years, 25% of the population is not going to go to the army, but I think the monkey wrench in all of this is that the Shas schools cannot really be regarded as Haredi. So I'm not here to talk about myself, but you know, later. Because whatever I say, people are then going to say, well, that's why you said this, because you're biased that direction. Let me just speak my piece and judge it for what it is. Barak points out that modern Orthodox might grow as more Haredim are forced to move into the workforce. That's the great fear of the Haredi leadership. They know that as soon as the government changes things, Haredim have to go into the workforce, that's going to be the end of Haredi society as we know it. It could develop like a Neri Yisrael Baltimore type of Haredi society, but many of them will simply drop out and join the religious Zionists, because when Haredim start going to work and start talking to people and are involved in the outside world, they will very quickly lose their extremism. That's why I'm not so afraid that, people are afraid that Israel is going to become like Iran and the secularists are going to all start moving because it's going to become a fundamentalist state. I don't think that's going to happen, because before that happens, the economy is going to collapse in the Haredi world and people are going to go at work, and that will moderate them. And you will have an American version of Haredism. You'll have people moving to Chardal. That's at least what I think is going to happen. And Bill says, the problem with Sephardi schools is poor education. You're right, poor secular education, you're right. The big if is, can Rabbi Chaim Amsalam, if he were to run in the next election, would he be able to get elected? It seems that he has a huge following among the Sephardim, but if it came down to voting for Avad Yosef versus voting for Chaim Amsalam, I think the Sephardim would actually go with Avad Yosef, even though they agree with Rabbi Chaim Amsalam much more than Avad Yosef. But after Avad Yosef is no longer around, after 120, you could see someone like Rav Chaim Amsalam becoming the most popular Sephardic figure in Israel. I think after Rav Avad Yosef, Amsalam is probably popular of the Sephardic figures. Although his teacher, Rabbi Meir Mazuz, had to backtrack a little on his support, Rabbi Mazuz is on the record, it's in print, in supporting what Amsalam said, not only about conversion, but about secular education. In numerous places, Rav Mazuz has said that this idea that everyone goes to yeshiva, that we support people in Kolel, this is not the Sephardic method. This is not the Sephardic approach. So, let's see. Okay, everyone, thank you very much. So we had 5 classes on the Skypeware. I hope you all found it interesting. We have 3 more classes. Devote ourselves to the Chasam Sofer in all 3 of those classes. Good night, everyone.